It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Just over a month before the 2014 midterm elections on November 4th, today we continue our conversations with candidates ahead of those November 4th elections. In the second half hour, I'll be joined by 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King. That coming up in just about a half an hour. In our first half hour, we welcome into our Iowa City studio 2nd District Democratic Congressman Dave Loebsack. Congressman Loebsack, welcome to our program.
As always, thanks, Ben.
We'd like to welcome our listeners to ask our listeners to chip in any questions or comments you have about Congressman Loebsack's policies. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Questions this half hour for Congressman Dave Loebsack. You can email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, tweet us at IPR Talk, or find Iowa Public Radio on Facebook. Let's talk about the international news that's been dominating our news for several weeks, Congressman. You serve on the House Armed Service Committee. Your son and his wife are majors in the U.S. Marine Corps. President Obama removed troops from Iraq with strong support reflected in U.S. public opinion. Now we're putting troops back in Iraq. Now we're also in an air campaign that involves Syria. What do you think about the decisions the president has made?
Well, we could spend the whole time talking about this particular issue, as you might imagine, Ben. It is that complex. But I think it would be a really good idea if the president and Speaker Boehner and Harry Reid called all of us back to Washington, D.C. right now so we could have a good conversation, a national debate about where we ought to go on this. I think that I think what the president's done in Iraq is probably covered by the initial authorization of military force. What he's doing in Syria, I think, requires something new from Congress.
What exactly do you think?
I think that what he's doing in Syria right now does require formal authorization of the use of military force, and that has not been approved yet by Congress. And what we're seeing, interestingly, is folks on both sides of the aisle calling for just that from Congress. Some want us to come back now, go back now. Some want to wait until a new Congress. I don't think it makes any sense for us to wait until January because operations are ongoing as we speak. And so I think it'd be a really good idea for us to go back to Congress and to have this debate on this. I think we need to have a serious national debate as well as to where we go from here. And part of that debate has to be, I believe, something I mentioned today. We had a statewide veterans conference here at the Memorial Union, and I was able to speak at the outset of that. You just mentioned that I have two kids in the Marine Corps. Terry and I are proud parents of those two children. But it's not just the fact that we have kids in the Marine Corps and that we're families of folks who've been deployed. I know a lot of families and a lot of folks who have been deployed in the National Guard here and other around the country, and I've visited those troops overseas a number of times, as you know. I believe that before we commit significant numbers of forces to Iraq, Syria, or anywhere, that we owe it to those families and that we owe it to those troops to have that national conversation and that we talk about the long-term consequences as well of any commitment of forces to action overseas. I think that's something that was not done in this country prior to the authorization of force in 2002, which again happened, by the way, in the middle of midterm elections. I don't mind feeling uncomfortable if that's what it takes for me to vote yes or no on this during the elections. But we've got to have that conversation. We have to think about those long-term consequences as well.
What about funding the war? You mentioned 2002, 2003, the Iraq War, also Afghanistan, two unfunded wars. Shouldn't Congress have to step up to the plate and say, we need to find funding for this and not just increase the debt to take care of it?
I agree. And, you know, the costs are still coming in for both of those wars, as we know. And talking to those veterans today, there are long-term costs that are very difficult to estimate, but we see those costs increasing every year because we have tens of thousands of folks who've come back from those conflicts, and they're going to need help for the rest of their lives at the VA medical facility here or in Des Moines or across the country. Those are the kinds of costs I'm talking about. We we need to do the best we can estimating what those costs are going to be before any commitment gets
made. Raising taxes to pay for it, to bonds, selling bonds like we used to in former times?
Well, I think this has to be part of a larger discussion of the budget and where we're going to put our money in terms of the budget. I will say that there has been some significant bipartisan support for our veterans over the years since I've been in office. That's a good thing, but we've got to continue that. We did pass legislation just recently, as you know, that did call for several billion dollars being devoted to the Veterans Administration, to the health care part of the Veterans Administration, so we can build new facilities, so we can hire more providers. We have to make sure that we do the right thing for these folks.
As a member of the House Armed Services Committee, what is your sense of what airstrikes alone, no boots on the ground in, say, Syria, limited number, a few hundred advisors, U.S. advisors in Iraq, what can we do with this without putting significant boots on the ground? Defeat ISIS or merely contain ISIS or perhaps not even contain ISIS?
Well, clearly ISIS is a threat to America and America's interest in the region. How much of a threat it is to our homeland remains to be seen, and that's something that I would like to speak to the administration about. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, I do have access to the intelligence data that's out there, but I would like to get back to Washington so we can have that conversation about that. This is all hypothetical at this point, sort of what we may have to do under particular conditions. I do believe that the president does need an authorization of military force from Congress for him to continue these actions that he has taken already without that authorization.
What sense do you have that Speaker Boehner will get the House back to Washington before the November 4th elections?
I'm not sure at this point, but excuse me, but it was encouraging to hear from him yesterday that he would bring us back should the president request that. And I think that would be the right thing to do.
Dave Loebsack, Congressman Dave Loebsack, our guest for this first half hour. Join our conversation with your questions for the Congressman, 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Facebook. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. A domestic issue, if I may jump to that, please, Congressman. The renewable fuel standard requires oil refineries to mix a certain amount, as you know, of course, of ethanol into their fuel before they ship it off to gas stations around the country. Obviously, Iowa has a great interest in this. There seemed to be a shift away from the renewable fuel mandate, but under pressure in the midterm elections, seems like that might be changing. What is happening there? And what is your position on maintaining or perhaps even increasing the mandate for the renewable fuel standard?
That's something that's really important not only to Iowa farmers and Iowa corn growers, but also keep in mind that this is biodiesel, not just ethanol. So it's both kinds of biofuels that we're talking about. But given the importance of the agricultural economy here in the state of Iowa, at least 25% of our gross domestic product is accounted for by the ag sector. This is really critical. A big part of why Iowa didn't suffer as much during the recession is because of ethanol and biodiesel, because of our agricultural sector. And the renewable fuel standard essentially set up a market for ethanol and biodiesel some years ago. When I first got to Congress, that was extended, and I worked very hard to get that extended as well. And then the EPA made the decision not so long ago to cut back on the renewable fuel standard. And I think that was the wrong thing to do. I've pressed this case. I've had meetings with White House folks. In fact, I went to the White House and took the case right directly to the president myself to make sure that we get back to where we should have been in the first place. I don't see the total volumes increasing, but if we can get them back to where they were initially before the EPA made this incorrect decision, I think that's the wrong way to go. You know, we are in the middle of a campaign season, and maybe my opponent has talked about this, but I've not heard her talk about this as far as I know. This is something that's really, really important for the economy of Iowa, not just, as I said, for corn growers, not just for soybean growers, but this is important for the economy of Iowa. And it's important, too, to move us away from fossil fuels into renewable fuels.
But
this is critical.
If I may, there are some environmental groups who say these renewable fuels, corn-based ethanol, may actually use more energy and emit more greenhouse gases than traditional fuels.
Yeah.
And so they're lining up strangely with the oil industry in trying to get rid of or reduce this mandate on the renewable fuels.
There are arguments on both sides. As somebody who used to teach at a college, I'm very aware that there are arguments on both sides, and we can have that argument. I believe that that's not the case. I don't think there's evidence for that argument. And certainly, as I said, this is something that's really important for Iowa. It's really important for our economy. It's important for jobs here in Iowa. We have to continue with this economic recovery, and I believe we've got to get that RFS back to where it should be.
We have Congressman Dave Lobsack with us for just over 10 minutes, 1-866-780-9100. Let's go to the phones and have you field a question, a few questions as time allows. Jim is with us in North Liberty. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the program, and you're speaking with Congressman Dave Lobsack.
Yes, I'd like to know, Congressman Lobsack, hear his discussion on the Rock Island Clean Line, which will carry electricity from northwest Iowa to the Chicago area, and on the Energy Transfer Partners 1,100-mile pipeline, which will carry North Dakota crude oil across 17 counties of Iowa, and on the Keystone XL pipeline.
Okay. The three things. We have just a few minutes, but yeah. We'll ask the congressman to briefly address those. Please.
Yeah, that's a lot. Look, the clean line, certainly that's something that a lot of folks are pushing very hard for because, as you know, about 27% of our electricity here in Iowa is generated from wind power. And that's a very, very important part of our energy. And I think it makes a lot of sense that we do what we can to get that energy to Iowa homes. And I understand that a lot of the energy that would go through the clean line would be taken out of the state of Iowa. But I'm all for making sure that we keep as much of that energy here as we possibly can. I just introduced legislation that would extend the production tax credit for wind energy by at least two more years. Steve King, who's following me on this program, and I have been leaders in the U.S. House of Representatives making sure that we can extend that PTC for as long as possible. It's great for jobs. It's great for clean energy. It's great for moving Iowa away from fossil fuels and depending upon fossil fuels for our electricity. So I think it makes a lot of sense. The other pipeline that you mentioned is kind of new in terms of its proposal. And that's something that I think we're going to have to study a lot more because that was just introduced as an idea not that long ago. And I know folks here are very concerned about that. It would stretch from the northwest part of the state down into the southeast part and would go through a lot of the counties in my district. As far as Keystone is concerned, you know, there are a lot of concerns environmentally. There are a lot of concerns that jobs may or may not be generated, the kinds of jobs that folks are talking about. You know, clearly also, if that's going to be, in fact, put into place, I would like to make sure that whatever oil is piped through that is actually not only refined here in the United States, but kept here in the United States. So there are a lot of different things to consider when it comes to Keystone. We've got to make sure we do the right thing on that issue.
Thank you very much, Jim, in North Liberty, for that question, those few questions, actually. Let's talk about health care briefly in the remaining minutes. Get this in. Of course, the last few elections, you've been up for re-election. Health care has been a hot-button issue, what's known as Obamacare. Republicans have been chanting up to this election, repeal, repeal, repeal. They continue their criticisms of the new health care law, but many aren't saying repeal Obamacare anymore. In fact, your opponent on this very program weeks ago was given several opportunities to say repeal and would not choose that word. Have we reached a point where we're saying it's time to look at what needs to be improved in this new health care law? And do you think that the repeal voices are fading?
I was listening to the program when my opponent refused to use the word repeal. Keep in mind that in 2006, she was actually for the individual mandate. Republicans at one time were for the individual mandate for good reasons, for reasons of personal responsibility. And then in 2008, she talked about repeal. And in 2010, she talked about repeal and reform or replace. More recently, she's not talking about repeal. She's talking about some of the good things, apparently, in the Affordable Care Act. But I think it's very confusing where my opponent is right now on that issue, where Dr. Miller-Meeks is on that issue. Where I am is that there have been good things that have come from this bill. Of course, I voted for it. We have probably at least 4,500 young adults in my congressional district right now who are still on their parents' health insurance plan, and they couldn't have been on that plan had this bill not passed. We have thousands of seniors who now get free annual checkups and for preventive care as well. We've got seniors who have saved $3,000 in prescription drug costs over the last 4 years, over $700 this year alone. Have there been problems, especially with the implementation? That can't be denied.
What would you like to correct in the law right now? Are there specifics that you would like to have the law change?
First, let me say that I'm open-minded. If someone wants to come to me and say, this is how we can make this law better, I'm open to listening to what they have to say. We had already a change to this very early on. There was a provision that required businesses to file a Form 1099, a tax form, for every transaction of $600 or more. I was one of the first Democrats to get on board to repeal that provision, and we did it on a bipartisan basis very early on in the process. There's a medical device tax that I think is onerous on folks who are producing those particular medical devices. I think that's the wrong way to go. I've already supported repeal of that. It has not come to a vote yet. That's another example of where I would be very supportive of a provision of this being repealed. I'm open, as I said, if folks have better ideas about how to make this a better bill. You know, it's a big piece of legislation. We had to make changes to Social Security and to Medicare. I'm open to doing that. It's all about making sure that folks have good, affordable, quality health care and that they have access to good, affordable health insurance as well. We've got a long ways to go, and I want to work on making sure as many folks as possible are covered.
5 minutes remaining with Congressman Loebsack. If you grew up in, not if you, but you did in fact grow up in Sioux City, a family that I hope I'm not going too far and saying was not a well-off family.
Not at all.
And you're now worked, many members of your family as well as yourself, worked hard to get ahead. Do you have the same? Do young people have the same opportunities today to get ahead in America? I guess I'm going toward this minimum wage debate that you're having. Are people disadvantaged anyway that you weren't in your time?
What I would like to see is that the same opportunities I had at least be maintained, if not increased. My first job when I was 16 years old was a federally funded program whereby I worked 40 hours a week in the summer of 1969, and this was a program for so-called disadvantaged kids. I worked at the Sioux City Waste Treatment Control Plant. You can only imagine what I did there. I had a lot of training for mucking out basements in Cedar Rapids and other places in 2008. That was an opportunity that I had and took advantage of, and it instilled in me, the work ethic, responsibility, how to get to work very early in the morning at a very young age. Those are the kinds of things that I want to continue to maintain, because we do have a lot of folks who are struggling. When I'm home every weekend, I'm talking to these folks at the convenience stores, in their places of work, just walking downtown in Fairfield, Iowa. I run into folks who are struggling all the time. When my opponent talks about increasing take-home pay, there's no logical way that increased take-home pay can in fact occur when she's opposed to an increase in the minimum wage. It doesn't make any sense. We've got to increase the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour over the next few years and index it to inflation. That's just one way. Getting this economy back on its feet, continuing to create good-paying jobs, as my sector's bill, my jobs bill that now is law, is going to help do. It's going to help match up folks with the proper skills for the jobs that are out there that now go wanting because there aren't enough people for those skills. Something I've been working on a number of years, but I got that through this summer, and I'm very proud of that.
There are three opportunities for Iowa to join the club of states that have elected women to Congress, either in the House of Representatives or to the Senate, your race being one of them, your opponent, Dr. Marionette Miller-Meeks, but there are also two other races, the Senate race and the 3rd District congressional race. Why do you think Iowa has yet to elect a woman to Congress, one of only two states?
I don't have a good explanation for that. I do think that it's quite unfortunate that that has been the case, and I feel very good that Stacey Apple's going to get elected in the central part of Iowa this fall.
Okay. Question here. Would you support bankruptcy protection for student loans?
What I would support, because we don't want it to get to that point, but what I would support is, and I do support legislation right now that's in the works, that's out there, that would allow students, once they graduate from college, to renegotiate their interest rates. That's something I think is really important. Well, you can do that on a house mortgage now. There's no reason why students shouldn't be able to do that on their interest rates, on their loans. I oppose the president and Republicans in Congress who increased the interest rates on these student loans. We should have kept it at 3.4%. Instead, now they're double that. That doesn't make any sense to me. We see in Iowa, as you know, a very, very heavy student loan debt for our students coming out, one of the highest in the country. As far as I'm concerned, we need to get those loan rates back to where they were before, and then we have to provide that kind of relief, that option at least, for those students who have accumulated a lot of debt over the years.
Let's quickly circle back to our initial topic of Iraq and ISIS. Should we not be able to control ISIS with the present measures? Would you support putting combat troops into Iraq, possibly Syria?
I have said, I've said that I'm not in favor of putting combat troops in Syria or Iraq for that matter. Of course, we have to be looking at the big picture here down the road, see where we are. But clearly what has to happen is folks in Iraq and Syria and the rest of the region who have just as much of an interest in stopping ISIS as we do, they have to make the contribution when it comes to those combat troops.
U.S. government estimating, and you're privy to much more information than I am, that more than 100 Americans are already fighting in Syria's civil war. Dozens of them are members of ISIS. How big a threat do you think that recruitment of Americans is for these forces?
Well, there's no doubt that it's a threat to us, and it's a bigger threat if they come back to the United States. We have to make sure that we do everything we can to monitor the movement of those folks, not only while they're overseas, but should they try to reenter the United States. And so I think we've got to redouble our efforts in terms of keeping track of those folks and making sure we know when they come back.
Congressman King, in the second half hour, has suggested in an interview that we need to have people watching in mosques around the country.
Well, I think we have to be very careful that we have the proper balance, obviously, between civil liberties and our national security. And that's something that we have to just make sure that we're monitoring on a constant basis. But I would make sure that we keep track of those folks when they come back into this country.
Okay, Congressman Dave Lobsack, thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thanks, Ben. Appreciate it.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll be joined by 4th District Republican Congressman Steve King. We welcome your questions and comments as we continue our series of conversations with candidates before these 2014 midterm elections. Hard to believe that we're already just about a month away from the November 4th elections, elections in which it's predicted, if you are believing the polls, that Republicans will make gains and possibly even win control of the U.S. Senate. Join our conversation with your questions for Congressman Steve King as we talk also with him about the war against ISIS, health care, the economy, jobs, and the environment. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Back in just a moment.